180 years ago, almost to the day, there was a crime of unimaginable horror. Mile Creek. In the litany of massacres of Aboriginal people, it is perhaps the best documented. 28 people from the Wiriay clan of the Gimilaray, hiding in a hut on Mile Creek Station near Bingara, were butchered by a group of convict stockmen armed with swords, not guns. The children in the group were decapitated and their remains were set on fire. Unlike many others, the full horror of this gruesome warlike atrocity on Australian soil became a matter of public record because some of those responsible were charged, tried, and executed for their crimes. The supposed ringleader, John Henry Fleming, who was 22 years old at the time, escaped and died an unrepentant old man at Wilberforce, northwest of Sydney, in 1894. But it's clear that justice in this case had unintended consequences. After Mile Creek, massacres were covered up and the perpetrators of mass murder went unpunished. One tactic to foil investigators was to destroy the evidence and to verbal witnesses. Conspiratorial silence was another, along with callous official indifference. The writer Bruce Pascoe delivered the keynote address at the 180th commemoration of the Mile Creek Massacre at a symposium in Armidale on the New South Wales Northern Tablelands. Now, Bruce is not a historian, he's a humanist, and he reckons there's no way we can move beyond the events of 1838 if we don't first confront them.
Mile Creek is one of those benchmark moments in Australian history and law. And the fact that the legal system operated as it ought to operate and convictions were made against men who killed other men and women and children, but then it was quickly overturned. So the right thing was done and then the wrong thing overrode it simply because it became obvious that justice wasn't acceptable to the white community.
In fact, there were two trials. There was a judge, I think his name was Plunkett, and when the jury acquitted the men of, you know, murder, Plunkett just stood up and said, this is not going to happen. You are all going to stay. You're on remand, and you're going to be charged again with a third crime, a third murder, the murder of a child. And then it seems like the consciences were pricked.
Mm.
But what do you think the historical significance is of Mile Creek?
Well, I think it's one of those test cases of colonialism. It ended up being a justification for the invasion of the land, and any sense of British law being the laurel on European heads was sent out the window by the fact that there was so much uproar about the obvious justice of convicting men who had killed other men and women. So there's no argument that this was one of the planks in the colonial effort to shelve responsibility for the invasion of Australia. And because it has never been resolved, it hangs there like a bad memory, worse than a bad memory. It's a nightmare for our people, but it's also, I think, a nightmare for Australia, because we know that our law can be corrupted by the influential. And in this case, it was corrupted by blatant racism. So we shouldn't allow that as a nation, because if we can't correct it, then it infects our whole legal structure, because we're just parading moral superiority and confidence in a legal system that is clearly carried out a misjustice.
The judge, I think, in the second trial, when the men were actually convicted and then executed, some of the men, I should say, he said that the blood of the victims cries out for not justice. I think he actually said used the word vengeance. I think Mile Creek certainly provoked some humanitarian vein somewhere in the country. Do you think there was any? Are there any positives in the way the legal system finally delivered, you know, what you might call justice?
It shows that it's possible, but it shows also that it's rare. We only have to look at deaths in custody in Australia. Just take one small sample of how the institution works, deaths in custody, and look at the appalling behaviour of police. Look at Palm Island and the absolute injustice. And, you know, the perpetrator gets promoted. You know, we haven't advanced much. There were some terrifically well-thought, well-elucidated arguments came out of Palm Island, came out of the various Western Australian deaths in custody, but they didn't hold sway. They didn't change the law because the opposition was too powerful. And until there are more people who believe in the eradication of injustice than those who seek to sweep it under the carpet, then we'll always lose. And our law will always be compromised. And we should be really, really adamant about protecting the law. And the legal fraternity should be those who want to protect it most because it's their job place.
One of the unintended consequences of Mile Creek and of the prosecution of the men, seven of the men who were responsible, was that in terms of this kind of, you know, act of mass murder, of attempted genocide, was that people who were committing these kind of crimes on the frontier knew that they had to cover them up, and they knew they had to dispose of the bodies, destroy all the evidence, verbal witnesses, and maintain a conspiratorial silence in order. And they knew that they could because the frontier was a lonely place. There weren't reporters out there watching their every move. There wasn't even a police presence. So the crime of massacre became much more secretive. So that was people often say that's a consequence of Mile Creek. Can you see how after 1838 that happened historically?
Yeah, the secrecy of the frontier is just colonial rule number one. Acts of barbarism against Aboriginal people to so-called clear the land, open up the land, disperse Aboriginal people, all of these phrases keep on cropping up in police files. They're just excuses for the broader colonial intent to open up the land that actually belonged to somebody else. So we study the enclosures of the fields in England that sent people to the poorhouse, and we wring our hands over it. In Australia, we don't do much hand-wringing. There are some good souls, really good souls, and they are to be commended. But like I said before, the majority of Australians don't wring their hands over the deaths of Aboriginal people on the frontier and still allow injustice against Aboriginal people to be perpetrated. So while these things happen, while the obvious deficits in Aboriginal health, the massive over-incarceration of Aboriginal people occurs, then it means that the people in power are sitting on their hands and that the institutions are so governed that they encourage people to sit on their hands. So we need to change the institutional rules because sometimes institutions claim that a rule binds their hands. Sometimes if a strong person holds their hands up and says, I confess, this is enough for me, then sometimes that rule can be seen by legal experts to have been flawed in the first place and should never have been upheld as a paragon of the legal system and inviolate. most laws are violated daily. So we're just fooling ourselves if we think that justice is being upheld in this instance, because racism builds its own laws, and the laws are intended to protect property holders and Aboriginal people, and never intended to be property holders. The fact that in the face of not being able to have much success in gaining land, although obviously the Northern Territory is largely Aboriginal owned, but down south we're buying our own land back bit by bit. That's not justice, it's just commerce. Commerce as usual. Highest bidder gets the land. And sometimes if it's known that an Aboriginal person is bidding for it, price goes up.
One of the arguments that you put in Dark Emu, your incredible book, which is now a production of Bangarra Dance Theatre, well, an adaptation of your book, one of the arguments you put there is that, you know, they didn't need a moral defence. They weren't interested in examples of Aboriginal ingenuity. They weren't interested in our aquaculture systems. They weren't interested in our fisheries, our permanent stone dwellings, if that's what you kind of, if that's what you hang civilization on. They weren't interested in that because they weren't here to observe a new civilization. Mm. They were only interested in replacing it. And I think you can see in Mile Creek this echo of we weren't worthy to possess the land in any sense, to even be on the land because they wanted it.
Mm. Yes, there were some intellectuals who had decided that Aboriginal people weren't intellectually capable of owning the land, and then their followers just took up the cudgel. And in any kind of violent program, you need thugs. And the racist person can pick any number of thugs in their communities. It's been proven worldwide over history. So you don't, you're never lacking in thuggery, in people who will butcher and bash in order to get their own way, because war brings out the worst in people. You know, we always talk about the honour of war, but for every tiny bit of honour, there's all this barbarism where people get off on killing other people in any side of any war, and that has been the case. But we have to wonder about how we allow it to happen, how the institutions allow that to happen, and what the intent was. And the intent was to take land off Aboriginal people, then, as a Christian nation, excuse it in some way. That is, these people weren't truly human and didn't own the land. So you've got a Christian and a legal disqualification based on nothing, based in the face of the evidence that the explorers saw. Many of the explorers were curious. That's what an explorer does. Goes into a new place and has a bit of a look around. It's not, you know, rocket science. You're on a horseback, you make a cup of tea, you ride on and you see things and you write them down, and people build statues for you ever after. But those explorers generally, and there were a couple of exceptions, but generally they weren't really looking for any kind of Aboriginal excellence. In fact, it was a nuisance, because what they'd been sent out to do, what they were paid to do, was to go and find grass and water. That's all they were interested in, because this was a pastoralist's dream, because Aboriginal people had set the place up, which suited sheep and cattle perfectly. You know, Sturt was one of the kinder explorers, one of the more intellectual explorers, but his brother was riding behind him, pegging out the land. So even though Sturt, to my knowledge, didn't kill any Aboriginal people, and he was rare, very rare in that situation, his brother was pegging out the land. So what was going through Charles Sturt's mind? You know, I see these buildings, my life has been saved by people who have fed me roast duck and cake and given me a house. But I know that in a fortnight's time, my brother will peg this land out. So it's, we can't gild the lily of colonialism. It was a brutal and cynical theft of land. We can finesse it any way we like, legally, morally, spiritually, but that's what it was. So I've got friends who argue with me about how severe it was. Now, severity is not what we're talking about. We're talking about law. If we want to argue about the invasion, let's argue it in a legal sense, truly legal sense. And the Mile Creek trials were that test. And morality won for a moment and closed immediately because the Australians wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't accept the law, and the law changed to suit them.
The writer, Bruce Pascoe, who delivered the keynote address at a symposium in Armidale to mark the 180th anniversary of the Mile Creek Massacre. And the commemorations include an exhibition curated by Bianca Beetson, featuring new work by Judy Watson, Robert Andrew, Fiona Foley and Laurie Nielsen. Mile Creek and Beyond is on in Armidale at the New England Regional Art Museum.